From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel in Washington.
And I'm Madeline Brand in California. The most positive news on the economy to date. Those words today from the White House describing a better-than-expected burst of growth late last year. Economists agreed that the news was indeed good, but as NPR's John Itzde reports, they disagree on whether the economy is truly out of the woods.
The 5.7% growth rate for October, November, and December significantly exceeded most economists' expectations. John Sylvia, who's the chief economist for Wells Fargo, says it adds to his belief in the recovery.
I'm far more confident now, having seen this number, that we will have sustained growth. There's no W here in this economic period. No double-dip recession.
What boosted Sylvia's outlook were some other numbers further down in the GDP report. For instance, consumer spending grew at a 2% annual rate in the fourth quarter, and business investment in equipment and software also grew nicely. Sylvia says that suggests confidence is returning, which is necessary to create a self-sustaining recovery. But Mark Sandy of Moody'sEconomy.com is skeptical.
I don't think the coast is clear. For that to occur, we need to see businesses start hiring again. I anticipate that this spring, but until that occurs, I don't think we conclude that we're home free here.
Sandy says the consumer spending number was good news, but points out that most of the 5.7% growth rate at the end of last year was due to businesses readjusting their inventory levels, ordering more from producers to restock their warehouses than they did at the depths of the recession. He argues that to make sure the recovery continues, there needs to be more government stimulus.
The risks are still high that we could backtrack into a recession. The foreclosure crisis, the lack of credit, these are all very serious threats. And most notable is the lack of hiring, at least so far. So that's why I think it's very important for policymakers to remain aggressive.
Sandy believes that if the job creation proposals President Obama unveiled during his State of the Union speech were quickly enacted, it could boost growth. He thinks it could increase from 2.5% this year to over 3%, enough to start bringing down the unemployment rate from 10% where it is today. But Wells Fargo's John Sylvia says more stimulus is not needed and not a good idea.
It's hard to justify adding permanent workers with these temporary programs. A lot of businesses are going to look at this and say, how can I hire somebody today if you're going to take away this temporary program in a year or two?
Undeterred by arguments like that, President Obama was pushing his jobs proposals today, and he had a tough audience, the Republican congressional retreat in Baltimore, where he outlined a new job tax credit for small businesses.
And here's how it would work. Employers would get a tax credit of up to $5,000 for every employee they add in 2010. They'd get a tax break for increases in wages as well.
In addition, the president is proposing that $30 billion of the rescue loans that banks are repaying be made available to small community banks so they can make loans to small businesses. The Congress will get these and other job creation proposals officially when the president sends his budget to Capitol Hill on Monday. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
The 2008 presidential election was the longest and most expensive in U.S. history. The campaign's the subject of a new book, Game Change, by two political reporters, John Heilman from New York Magazine and Time Magazine's Mark Halperin. The book's revelations have made headlines, but our critic-at-large John Powers says the authors mostly add to the body of political writing that feeds public cynicism about American elections.
Back when Theodore White did his groundbreaking book, The Making of the President, 1960, it was easy to write about elections. Most Americans didn't know very much about how campaigns actually worked. These days, we're all experts on push polling, NASCAR dads, and those oddball Iowa caucuses. For an election book to register now, it must offer something new, something hot. It has to dish. If any account of the 2008 campaign does just that, it's Game Change by John Heilman and Mark Halperin, a laughably written yet highly readable book that The Economist has described as high-quality political porn. Because most of its pages rehearse yet again the campaign's greatest hits. You know, Bill Clinton's gaffes, Obama's trouble with Reverend Wright, Palin's disastrous interview with Katie Couric. Its real selling point is its juicy stuff. That Harry Reid talked about Obama's lack of Negro dialect. That McCain's aides thought Palin unfit to be Veep. And that Elizabeth Edwards behaved hideously to her husband's campaign staff. Such TMZ-ish revelations have won the book lots of headlines. But Game Change also raises questions about a certain kind of political reporting. The first is about sourcing. To get their scoops, the authors have relied on so-called deep background interviews with anonymous sources. They've taken a lot of heat for this approach, which seemingly allows disgruntled losers to say just about anything under a cloak of secrecy. Now, this doesn't mean that what Heidelman and Halperin describe didn't happen. They're solid reporters, and when they say something took place, I believe them. Indeed, both Reed and Edwards essentially acknowledge that they did what the book says they did. The trouble with blind sources has less to do with facts than with what those facts mean. Early on, we're told that Hillary Clinton freaked out so much on losing Iowa that one of her most senior aides thought, "This woman shouldn't be president." A judgment so damning, the authors naturally put it in italics. I don't doubt that this happened, yet a lot depends on whose judgment we're getting. Was this unnamed aide someone Clinton turned on? Did he or she quit the campaign because Hillary was unfit? Or was this simply the kind of angry thought we all have in the heat of the moment and then vanishes the next day? If we don't know the story's source, we can't assess whether it's a serious judgment of Hillary or just a cheap shot. To say this is to confront another problem, the inability to see what really matters in a campaign. Favoring gossip over analysis, Heilman and Halperin can't be bothered to discuss substantive things like Clinton's vote for the Iraq War resolution. It only matters to them as an electoral liability. Or the way that Obama's early big money backers were rich Wall Street bundlers. A fact that just might have some bearing on how he's handled the financial crisis. Instead, Game Change traffics in anecdotes that usually make Obama look good. He won, after all. And make the losers look petty, sleazy, or worse. We see McCain flipping off his wife Cindy while showering her with F-bombs. As for Elizabeth Edwards, the authors happily debunk her saintly image, telling us that her husband's team saw her as, quote, an abusive, intrusive, paranoid, condescending, crazy woman. Now, I realize that journalism is not a gentlemanly business, but I'm not sure there's any reason, other than a desire for sales, to tell us about a defeated candidate's marital spats, or to take such ungallant glee in trashing a woman with life-threatening cancer and an adulterous husband whose political career is now kaput. Such an approach only feeds public cynicism, the belief that those running for office are all creeps and phonies. I don't want to sound like a sucker, but the truth is more complicated and more interesting. Politics is about character, of course, often bad character, but it's also about values, ideas, and yes, even policies. What makes presidential candidates so endlessly fascinating is that their whole life becomes a negotiation between their almost pathological ambition and their idealistic dreams of how they'd like to remake the world. It's a negotiation that includes us, the American people, who have ambitions and desires of our own. Never was this a grander story than in 2008, the greatest presidential campaign of our lives. And it's depressing to see men as smart as Heilman and Halperin fritter it all away. Finishing their book, I realized that they hadn't told me a single important thing I didn't already know. On the contrary, they've taken an election that proved how big this country really is and made it seem as small as a reality show.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and writes the Absolute Powers blog for Vogue.com.
We have an update now and a story from Monday's program. Our co-host Melissa Block reported from Lake Placid, New York, on a World Cup ski cross race. That's where four skiers at a time race down a twisty course full of bumps and jumps. Ski cross is making its Olympic debut in Vancouver next month. It's both thrilling and dangerous. And as Melissa reported, a French skier at that World Cup race had a terrible accident. Florent Astier careened off the course. He was medevaced out, and doctors feared he might be paralyzed.
Well, today Melissa has learned that the 23-year-old skier is, in fact, paralyzed from the chest and shoulder area down after suffering a C5 vertebra fracture and severe spinal cord injury. Doctors treating Mr. Astier at Fletcher Allen Healthcare in Burlington, Vermont, say it's too early to project his long-term outcome. Mr. Astier's family is with him at the hospital. Joe Fitzgerald, the race director for the International Ski Federation, FIS, says this is the most serious accident they've ever had in 7 years of ski cross World Cup races. He added, "It is very unfortunate. We're all very sad for him."
listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. NASA has certainly got its money's worth out of its Mars rovers. Designed to operate for just a few weeks, Spirit and Opportunity have been chugging along collecting data from Mars for 6 years. But this past spring, Spirit got stuck in the sand. It's caught in a patch of Martian soil that's tricky to navigate, and NASA says it may be stuck there for good. So what do you do if you're driving the rover and you've lost your locomotion? Do you give up on Spirit? Our next guest says no, and he should know about it. Steve Squires is principal investigator for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover mission and a professor of astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca. Welcome back.
Good to talk to you, Ira. How are you?
So how stuck are we?
Yeah, it's been pretty rough lately. We're continuing to turn the wheels. We're continuing to try to move the vehicle. In a really good day, we'll go 5 centimeters, a couple inches. It's
wow.
A very, very difficult predicament that we've gotten into. Not only is the sand that we're in very soft and very deep, but two of Spirit's 6 wheels have now failed. They don't turn anymore. And when you're dragging 2 dead wheels, it's hard to go anywhere.
I say that every morning when I get up. all is not lost, though, right? You can use it as a stationary base if you have to.
Yeah, there are a couple things. I mean, first of all, we're not going to stop trying to move this thing. We're not going to stop trying to turn the wheels. Even if we can only move short distances of a few centimeters, there's a substantial scientific value to that. So we are going to keep turning Spirit's wheels and seeing what happens. But even if Spirit never leaves its current location, there's a lot of science that we can do, including some new stuff we've never done before.
Such as?
Well, the one I'm most excited about, believe it or not, we think we can use Spirit to find out whether or not the core of Mars is made of liquid or solid iron. Mm-hmm. Turns out that if you track a spacecraft very precisely, you can measure its position in space with enormous accuracy. And if the rover is not going anywhere, then the only motions you're seeing are the motion of Mars in its orbit, which we understand very well, and then the spin of Mars on its axis. And so by tracking the spacecraft, we can determine that spin very precisely. And what we can measure is how the spin axis of Mars is oriented in space. Mm-hmm. Now, the spin axis of Mars doesn't stay fixed in space. It wobbles a little bit like a top or a gyroscope. And it turns out that if Mars has a solid core, it wobbles in one fashion. And if it has a liquid core, it wobbles a little differently. Mm-hmm. And we think that by tracking Spirit's radio signal for about 6 months, as long as the rover's not moving too much, that we can tell the difference between those two wobbles and find out whether it's got a liquid core or a solid core.
And you want to know that? Why? What does that mean?
Well, that's a fundamental characteristic of the inside of a planet. Mm. Some planets have liquid in their interior. Some are solid. The Earth has a solid inner core and a liquid outer core. We want to learn what the inside of Mars is like. We've done a great job of studying the surface of Mars, but if you want to understand the planet as a whole, how it's evolved over time, knowing what's going on inside is important too.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter is @SciFri, @SCIFRI. Talking with Stephen Squires. When will you know, from what I understand, let me rephrase this, I understand you also have a problem about the upcoming winter, whether you'll survive the winter or not sitting there.
Winters are always tough for this rover because we're pretty far from the equator with Spirit. When it gets to be wintertime, the sun drops low in the sky, and if you're a solar-powered rover, that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So we expect this rover, this winter rather, to be particularly harsh. In previous winters, we've been able to kind of tilt the solar arrays towards the sun by driving on a sunward-facing slope. We can't do that right now. So it's going to be a tough winter for this vehicle. We think the chances of survival are actually quite good. But we think it's likely that the rover is going to have to drop into a kind of a hibernation mode for a number of months. And we may actually go 2, 3, 4, 6 months even without hearing from the vehicle. But then when springtime comes and the sun rises higher in the sky, good chance that Spirit will wake up and start talking to us again.
So it's so crippled that you can't even now tilt it to the right direction that it would need to be tilted?
We can. The only way you can tilt this vehicle is by driving it onto a hillside that faces the direction you want to tilt. And we're only moving small distances right now as we turn the wheel, so that's tough to do.
What about all the suggestions that have been coming in, things like using the robot's arm, you know, to lift it up and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, those are great. I have gotten so many wonderful emails from people because, you know, people have gotten wrapped up in this drama. And everybody has had an experience of getting their car stuck somewhere and trying to figure out how to get it out. So this is a familiar predicament to many people. And we've gotten so many suggestions that, you know, some of them are actually very useful, very helpful, and some of them we have been using. Others, for example, using the arm, wish we could do it. You know, I wish we could use the arm to help us, but that arm was designed for precision placement of delicate scientific instruments. It is not strong enough, I'm afraid, to push Spirit out from its current location. So we're stuck to what we can do with the wheels, and we're doing the best we can with that.
Gosh, I remember those days when we used to rock the old car out of the sand back and forth. Yep. You can't do that. But can you use the arm to shove sand under the wheels? I remember in the beach, if you got too deep, your wheels would start spinning because the sand is holding the car up now and there's no traction.
One thing that we've talked about would be using the arm to try to nudge a rock underneath the left front wheel. It doesn't help to put anything under the right front wheel because that wheel doesn't turn. It's one of the ones that has failed.
Right.
We've talked maybe come springtime about using the arm to try to nudge a rock under that left front wheel and get a little traction that way. We'll see. If the rover survives the winter and springtime comes and that looks like it's still a useful thing to try, then maybe we'll try it.
Charles in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question and I guess a comment. I really appreciate the rover being up on Mars and it being our first step towards, I guess, space exploration. I guess then my question is, what are we working towards to further longer exploration in space, knowing that us living on Earth, we have so much knowledge out there in space. I guess my question is, what is our next step past Mars?
Thanks, Charles.
Well, there are a lot of things still about to happen on Mars besides the continuing operation of Spirit and Opportunity and a couple of orbiters, several orbiters that are orbiting Mars right now. There's a new mission called the Mars Science Laboratory mission that's going to launch in 2011, is going to put a big, more capable rover than Spirit and Opportunity onto the surface and operate that for probably a fairly extended period of time. What I'd like to see happen at Mars sometime in the future is a mission that would actually bring rocks back from the Martian surface, land on the surface, collect rocks, bring them back to Earth, and put them into the best laboratories on Earth and really find out in much more detail what those are like. Look further out in the solar system. You know, my favorite thing out there has always been Europa. It's one of the moons of Jupiter. It's got a crust of ice. Beneath that crust of ice, there appears to be an ocean of liquid water, and boy, I'd love to know what's in that ocean.
Yeah, but there was a plan, if I remember back in my dusty memory, of something called a Mars sample return mission that was planned. Did that just get scrubbed or there was no money for it after a while? Or what happened with that?
We've been talking about Mars sample return for a very long time, bringing samples back.
Right.
It turns out that when you look hard at what it really takes to do it, it's an enormously challenging mission technically, and it's going to be very, very expensive. And so it's not something that's in the immediate future right now. We've got to probably take the problem and kind of break it down into pieces. Have one spacecraft that goes and collects the samples, another one that goes later and picks them up and takes them into Mars orbit, maybe another one that goes and finds those and brings them back to Earth. So by breaking up the problem into several parts, you can probably make the whole thing a bit more affordable.
So where is Spirit's sister ship, so to speak, sister rover Opportunity? Where is that vehicle?
Opportunity's on the other side of the planet, has six good wheels and is doing very well. We just today pulled up to the rim of the freshest impact crater we've ever seen on Mars with either rover. It's a crater called Concepcion. It's named after one of Magellan's ships. And geologically, it formed yesterday. Now, I don't know when it actually formed, but it's the youngest, freshest, most recent crater that we've ever seen on Mars. It's kind of a scary-looking place, actually. I just saw the first good pictures of it this morning. If you go to marsrovers.jpl.nasa.gov, you can see the pictures virtually as they come down from the spacecraft. And it's a very rocky, blocky, kind of dangerous-looking place. So we're going to have to watch our step around Concepcion. But it's a very interesting feature, unlike anything we've seen before.
Is that where you were headed all this time?
No, this is just an interesting stop along the way. Where we're headed is a crater called Endeavor, which is huge. This thing is more than 10 miles in diameter. It's an enormous feature. It's still quite far away. But this is sort of an interesting little way station on the way to Endeavor.
Mm-hmm. So when getting back to Spirit, when do you decide to give up trying to pull her out of the sand there?
Well, we're never going to give up trying to move the vehicle, okay? Our intention is to continue to try to move the vehicle whenever we can, because even if all we get is small amounts of motion, even if it only moves 5 centimeters, 10 centimeters, we have an arm on the front of the vehicle, and it's only about the size of a human arm. It doesn't have a very long reach. And so if you can just reposition the rover even slightly, you can bring new patches of soil within reach of that arm, and you can study new things. Mm-hmm. So we're going to keep trying to move it, but how far we're going to move is hard to say, and our recent experience mm-hmm. suggests not very far. One thing that we do have to realize, though, is that very soon, probably simply within the next few weeks, we're going to have to stop all attempts to move the vehicle as winter becomes more severe. We just won't have the power to do it. And that's the point at which we'll just kind of hunker down and try to survive until spring comes. And that's coming real soon.
So it has a power down mode to just go to sleep for a while.
It has a kind of a hibernation mode that it goes into. And we don't command it to do it. We don't tell the rover it's time to hibernate. The rover senses that it has very little power and goes into that hibernation mode all by itself, and kind of stays that way until the power comes back up again. That's the way it preserves as much power on board as it can.
So you just have to keep your fingers crossed that come spring, it'll
power
itself back up.
Yeah, keep the fingers crossed, be very patient, and hope for the best. That's all we can do.
All right, Steve, thank you, and good luck to you.
Thanks very much. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Steve. Stephen Squires is the principal investigator for NASA's Mars Exploration Rover mission and professor of astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca, and he was talking to us from a studio at the campus there in Cornell.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me as usual. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Michelle. Well, political and media circles here in Washington, D.C. are abuzz about the saga of former North Carolina senator and presidential hopeful John Edwards. Now, last week, after previous adamant denials, Edwards admitted he did father a child by his mistress, Riel Hunter. And this week, we're hearing reports that John and Elizabeth Edwards have legally separated.
And Lee, we can always count on our very own Tell Me More producer, Alicia Montgomery, to rattle our blog readers. Alicia wrote a post last week taking issue with marital infidelity by public figures. She said it suggests a great deal about their integrity as leaders, but not everybody agreed. We caught up with blogger Matthew, who posted this response.
If Americans would grow up, then John Edwards would not have had to scuttle around trying to cover his track so desperately. It would also have helped if he had better taste in women and better sense with sex. Wear a condom, man, and for good measure, find a lover who doesn't want to get pregnant. If Americans realize that one's sex life has no connection to one's presidential or leadership abilities, then none of LaFaire Edwards would matter to anyone besides those directly involved.
Well, thank you, Matthew. Tell us what you really think. Lee, any updates?
Yes, a few updates, Michelle. In December, we spoke with the president of Jackson State University, Ronald Mason, who, along with the heads of two other historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, Alcorn State and Mississippi Valley State University, opposed Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour's proposal to merge the schools. But now Mason seems to have had a change in his perspective about a merger. We've obtained a copy of a PowerPoint presentation made by Mason that does, in fact, call for the three schools to be merged into one. And this week he told a Mississippi newspaper that such an idea, quote, really would be a model for the next generation of HBCUs. Now, we asked Mr. Mason to explain the appearance shift, and he issued a statement that reads in part, quote, I simply offered one suggestion on how to survive and get stronger. Now, the full statement will be available on our website, and we've invited Mr. Mason back on our program, Michelle, to explain the change in his thinking.
Good idea.
And finally, about this time last year, we reported on a tragic story out of Oklahoma. Oakland, California, 22-year-old Oscar Grant, an unarmed black man, was shot and killed by then-transit police officer Johannes Mescherle, who is white. Now, the shooting was captured on videotape, and the incident sparked outrage and rioting in the city. Mescherle has since resigned and is waiting to be tried on murder charges. But Wednesday, Michelle, city transit officials announced a $1.5 million settlement for Grant's 5-year-old daughter, Tatiana.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.